The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Hello, everyone. How are you? I'm very happy to, to be here in Philadelphia and in this library. I thank all of you for coming out to listen to the stories we are going to tell, David and myself. David, I'm very happy to see you again. Lynn, thank you for your great introduction, and to Andy. And again, our people have a saying, a story is never complete until someone has listened to you. So I'm happy to have you. Without you, who would be listening to me? I'm going to read from my story, my parents' bedroom. The narrator is this 8-year-old or 9-year-old girl, and she's both Hutu and Tutsi. These tribes in Rwanda are so different from the tribes in my country, because in my country every tribe has an ancestral home. If something happened in one part of the country, you could run to your ancestral home and fight from there. The Hausas have the north, the Igbos are in the east, and every tribe, not so in Rwanda. In Rwanda, everybody lives with everybody, and so it basically was a question of neighbors, doing neighbors in. You had no place to run to. Again, in my country, we speak different ethnic languages. In Rwanda, it's one language. So it's difficult to actually know how you could classify these people as ethnically different or as different tribes when they eat the same food, speak the same language. So you basically had to look at people's futures to say you are from this tribe or from that tribe. And of course, they had the ID cards that said you are Hutu and you are Tutsi. All right, enough introduction. When I was younger, I used to ride into the hills on Papa's shoulders. We were always visiting Mama's family place in the next valley. Papa told me that when he first met my mom, she was my age, and they played together in these hills. They went to the same primary school and university. In the hills, you can see the clouds moving away like incense in a church. Our country is full of winds, and in the hills, they blow at your eyes until tears stain your cheeks. They suck through the valleys like hungry cows. The birds rise and tumble and swing, their voices mixing with the winds. When Papa laughs his jolly, jolly laugh, the winds carry his voice too. From the top of the hills, you can see that the earth is red. You can see stands of banana and plantain trees, their middle leaves rolled up like yellow-green swords slicing the wind. You can see fields of coffee with farmers wading through them, piggybacking their baskets. When you climb the hills in the dry season, your feet are powdered with dust. When it rains, the red earth runs like blood under green skin. There are tendrils everywhere, and insects come out of the soil. I walk tall and proud in our neighborhood. The bullies all know that Papa will attack anyone who messes with me. Even when he is drunk on banana beer, my tears sober him. Sometimes he even goes after my mother for making his girl sad. As the mob closes in on our house, chanting, the ceiling people begin to pray. I recognize their voices as those of our Tutsi neighbors and fellow parishioners. They are silent as Papa opens the front door to the crowd, which is bigger than last night's, and pushes into our home like flood water. These people look tired, yet they sing on like drunks. Their weapons and hands and shoes and clothes are covered with blood, their palms slimy. Our house suddenly smells like an abattoir. I see the man who attacked me. His yellow trousers are now reddish brown. He stares at me. I hold on to my father, who is hanging his head. My mother runs into the bedroom. Four men are restraining my uncle, who still wants to kill us. I run to my mother and sit with her on the bed. Soon, the mob enters the room too, bringing Papa. They give Papa a big machete. He begins to tremble, his eyes blinking. A man tears me away from my mother and pushes me towards my brother, Jean, who is in the corner. Papa is standing before my mother, his fingers on the knife's handle. My people, he mumbles. Let another do it, please. No, you do it, traitor. My uncle shouts, struggling with those holding him. You were with us when I killed Annette yesterday, my pregnant wife. I killed her. You can't keep yours. Where did you disappear to when we came here last night? You love your family more than I love mine, yes? If we kill your wife for you, my granduncle says, we must kill you and your children too. He thuds his stick. Otherwise, after cleansing our land of Tutsi nuisance, your children will come after us. We must remain one. Nothing shall dilute our blood, not God, not marriage. My uncle shouts, Monique, how many Tutsis has Papa hidden? My husband, be a man. My mother interrupts, looking down. Monique, answer! Someone yells. The crowd of Hutus murmur and become impatient. Woye Subiza. My husband, you promised me. Papa lands the machete on Maman's head. Her voice chokes and she falls off the bed and onto her back on the wooden floor. It's like a dream. The knife tumbles out of Papa's hand. His eyes are closed, his face calm, though he's shaking. My mother straightens out on the floor as if she were yawning. Her feet kick and her chest rises and locks as if she were holding her breath. There is blood everywhere on everybody around her. It flows into my mother's eyes. She looks at us through the blood. She sees Papa become one of them. Sees his people telling him bad things. The blood overflows her eyelids and Maman is weeping red tears. My bladder softens and pee flows down my legs toward the blood. The blood overpowers it, bathing my feet. Papa opens his eyes slowly. His breaths are long and slow. He bends down and closes Maman's eyes with trembling hands. And then they begin to leave, some patting him on the back. Now my uncle is calm, stroking his goatee. He tucks at Papa's sleeve. My father covers my mother with a white bedspread and then goes off with the mob without looking at me or my brother. My mother's ring and money disappear with them. I cry with the ceiling people until my voice cracks and my tongue dries up. No one can ever call me Shenge again. I want to sit with my mother forever, and I want to run away at the same time. Sometimes I think she's sleeping under the bedspread. and that the blood is not hers. I don't want to wake her up. My mind is no longer mine. It's doing things on its own. It begins to run backward. And I see the blood flowing back into my mouth. I see her rising suddenly, and as suddenly as she fell, I see Papa's knife lifting from her hair. She's saying, "Me promised you." "Yes, Mama," I say, "you promised me." My brother is startled by my shout. He stamps around in the blood as if he were playing in mud. I begin to think of my mother as one of the people in the ceiling. It is not safe for her to come down yet. She's lying up there quietly holding on to the rafters, just as she must have been last night when the man in the yellow trousers attacked me. She's waiting for the right time to cry with me. I think that my uncle is hiding my auntie, Annette, in his ceiling and fooling everyone into believing that he killed her. I see her lying face up on a wooden beam with a mountain belly, the way I lie on the lowest branch of our mango tree and try to count the fruit. Soon, Uncle Andre will bring her down gently. She'll give birth, and my uncle will cover her mouth with Belgian kisses. My brother Jean yanks the cloth off Maman and tries to wake her. He straightens her finger, but it bends back slowly, as if she were teasing him. He tries to bring together the two halves of my mother's head without success. He sticks his fingers into my mother's hair and knits it, the blood thick like red shampoo. As the ceiling people weep, he wipes his hands on her clothes and walks outside giggling. I wander from room to room listening to her voice among the ceiling voices. When there is silence, her presence fills my heart. "Forgive us, Monique," Madame Therese says from the palace ceiling. "We will always support you and John." Her husband stammers from above my room. "Your parents are good people, Monique. We'll pay your school fees. You are ours now." "Get this dead body off me!" Grandma de Matin groans from above the corridor. "It's dead, it's dead. Just be patient," someone close to her says. "We'll send the dead down carefully before they fall through." Some praise God for the way my parents' marriage has saved them. Grandmaman de Matin becomes hysterical, forcing everyone to rearrange themselves in the ceiling in the corridor. I identify each voice, but my mother's voice isn't there. Why hasn't she said something to me? Why doesn't she order me to go and shower? All the things my mother told me came at me at once, and yet separately, in play, in anger, in fear. There is a command, a lullaby, the sound of a kiss on my cheek. Perhaps she is still trying to protect me from what is to come. She's capable of doing that, I know, just as she stopped Papa from telling me that he was going to smash her head. "I'm waiting for Maman," I tell the ceiling people. "She's gone, Monique." No, I know now, she's up there. "You get your hehe, where?" "Stop lying. Tell my mom to talk to me." The palace ceiling is now creaking and sagging in the middle, and Madame Therese starts to laugh like a drunk. "You are right, Monique. We are just kidding. Smart girl, yes. Your mother is up here. But she will come down only if you go outside to get your brother. She's had a long day." "Here go, madame," I say. "Wake her up. She's hearing you," Monsieur Pierre Nzabimana says suddenly from above the kitchen. He hasn't said anything all this while. His voice calms me and I move toward it, my eyes fixed on the ceiling. Someone begins the katina in a harsh, rapid whisper. It's not my mother. She always takes her time to say her prayers. Do you want your mother to fall with the ceiling on you? Monsieur Perry says, no, I say. Then, girl, leave the house and don't come back. The ceiling above the altar begins to tear apart from the wall, and the people scurry away from that end like giant lizards. I pick up the broken crucifix and hurry outside. There are corpses everywhere. Their clothes are dancing in the wind. Where blood has soaked to the earth, the grass doesn't move. Vultures are poking the dead with their long beaks. Jean is driving them away, stamping his feet and swelling his arms. His hands are stained because he's been trying to raise the dead. He's not laughing anymore. His eyes are wide open, and there's a frown on his babyish forehead. When he wanders toward the UN soldiers at the corner, their rifles shiny in the twilight, they're walking away from him as if they were a mirage. The vultures are following Jean. I screamed at them, but they continue to taunt him like stubborn mosquitoes. Jean doesn't hear. He sits on the ground, kicking his legs and crying because the soldiers won't wait for him. I squat before my brother, begging him to climb onto my back. He does and keeps quiet. We limp on into the chilly night, ascending the stony road into the hills. The blood has dried into our clothes like starch. There's a smaller mob coming toward us. Monsieur Henri is among them. He's carrying a huge torch, and the flame is eating the night in large windy gulps. These are our people on Maman's side, and they are all in military clothes. Like another soccer fan club, they're chanting about how they're going to kill Papa's people. Some of them have guns. If Papa couldn't spare my mother's life, would my mother's relatives spare mine or my brother's? I slip into the bush with my brother on my back, one hand holding the crucifix, the other shielding my eyes from the tall grass and the branches, my feet cold and bracing for thorns. Jean presses hard against me, his face digging into my back. Our mother says, do not be afraid, I tell him. Then we lie down on the crucifix to hide its brightness. We want to live. We don't want to die. I must be strong. After the mob runs past us, I return to the road and look back. They drag Maman out by the legs and set fire to the house. By the time their fellow Tutsis in the ceiling begin to shout, the fire is unstoppable. They run on. They run after Papa's people. We walk forward. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming out tonight. I'm honored to be reading after UM. Did I say that right? I have to practice UM, right? It's shorter than Robleski. Maybe it has its own trickinesses. That was amazing. Thanks for reading that. What I thought I would do is read a little bit about from the middle of the story of Edgar Sawtelle. And I'm going to guess that most of you know some of the basics of the story. Lynn summarized it nicely. I have for a long time called it a boy and his dog story for grown-ups. Although this year, now that it's out in paperback, I'm calling it a case of backwoods science fiction instead. possibly the only member of that category ever written. Just a little bit of background. Edgar is, the year is 1972 or 73, depending on where you are in the book. Edgar is mute but not deaf. He is growing up on a farm in remote northern Wisconsin, where the Sawtells raise and train an entirely fictional breed of dog that are the result of 50 years of breeding, training, and selection for a kind of brilliance in companionship. Although the nature of that brilliance is underspecified in just the way that the physical form of the dogs is underspecified. In the passage I'm going to read tonight, which is the beginning of the third of five parts, I don't know, it's a strange little scene. I call it a mood piece, I guess, is one way to describe it. And what has happened at this point in the story is that there has been a death in the family, for which Edgar feels at least partly responsible. And the night before, he has been outside in this farm wandering in the rain, and he has come about information in an unusual way that suggests at least that much of what he thought was true of the situation that he and his family are in has not been as he thought, and in fact, in particular, that the loss in his family he no longer believes was simply fate. You're going to get a little tour of the farm as an aside in this chapter. And you're also, in particular, you're going to see featured a barn of gigantic proportions. That's practically a character of its own in this book, and which was converted in the 1920s to a kennel by Edgar's grandfather. The previous scene ends with Edgar standing in the rain at night in front of that barn. The name of this chapter is Awakening. He came up out of a darkness that was not sleep, but something vaster and more comforting. The black of willful unconsciousness, or perhaps the night that precedes the first awakening, which babies know in the womb and forget ever after. There was S.A.'s breath panting slow and hot against his face. When he cracked an eyelid, her jet-whiskered muzzle and curious eye filled his vision. And he pushed her away and curled his head to his knees and squeezed his eyelids shut. Even so, he'd glimpsed enough to know that he lay inside the run farthest from the doors and nearest the whelping room, and that the bare lights blazed along the kennel aisle. Outside, rain fell, roaring, a torrent against the roof. There was the rustle of canvas flaps, and another dog trotted up, this time Tinder, who dug his muzzle into the crevice between Edgar's chin and chest and snuffled and drew back and cocked his head with a low, puzzled groan. Bits of straw began to itch along his neck. His shirt clung to his ribs, gelid and damp. A spasm shook his body, then another, and he gasped and, despite himself, drew a full breath that carried into him the odors of the kennel, sweat and urine, straw and turpentine, blood and defecation and birth and life and death. All of it alien and bitter, as if the whole history of the place itself had suddenly blossomed in his chest. And with it, masked until the last instant, the memory of what had happened in the night. Then Essay and Tinder accosted him together. He could summon only the strength to sit cross-legged against the wooden wall and bury his face in his arms, counting by sound the dogs shuffling through the straw in their pens as rain thundered onto the barn. When he lifted his head again, Essay and Tinder stammered before him and snaked their necks against his palms and shimmied. In time, he pushed himself upright. Patches of wet cloth sucked away from his skin. He slipped out of the pen and walked to the Dutch doors and stood with one hand on the latch, listening to water sheeting off the eaves. He drew a breath and swung the door outward. The sapphire sky above floated a small, lone cloud made orange by the sunrise. The new leaves on the maple stirred and quaked. Sparrows cartwheeled over the wet field like glazier's points against the sky, and the swallows nesting in the eaves plunged into the morning air. The house burned white against the green of the woods, the Impala neon blue. But there was no torrent to be seen, not even a drizzle. The sound of falling rain possessed him for one moment more and then vanished. He was past the milk house before he remembered the syringe and turned and found it crushed in the center of a grassy puddle, needle snapped, barrel broken and awash. He cupped it in his palm and carried the pieces to the old silo, where he pitched them through the rusted iron rungs and listened as they struck the far curve of cement and stone with a papery ring. Then he walked up the driveway, faster, as he passed the house, the orchard, the mailbox. He started up the road, wheeled, and headed the other way, breaking into a run and then dropping into a jerky, reined-up step. He turned again. After a moment, he found himself walking back down the driveway, and he began to circle the house in that same halting stride. 5 times around, 10, 20 times. Each time he passed the old apple tree, its lowest branches tugged at him, and he brushed them away until he finally came to rest, panting, caught for the umpteenth time. And at last he turned to look at it. It was an old tree, old already when he was born, maybe older than the house itself. At eye level, the trunk split into 3 thick and nearly horizontal limbs, the longest of which arced toward the house and ended suddenly in a mass of waxy leaves. The branch would have continued through the kitchen window had it not been pruned mid-limb. He was shaking and chilled, and his fingers were stiff, but he managed to boost himself into the crotch of the tree, and from there he worked himself onto the limb. The bark felt greasy from long days of rain. Past halfway, the branch began to buck and wobble under his weight. Rainwater, cupped in the new foliage, showered him every time he moved. He worked slowly along. When he got to the stump end, he steadied himself by gripping a horn-like pair of limbs and settled his sternum against the branch and lay outstretched, a swimmer among the boughs. The window over the sink was closed, the gingham curtains parted to either side. The thin morning light was not enough to illuminate the interior, and at first only the orange power light at the base of the freezer was visible, its bulb winking and flickering. His breaths made the limb tremble like the string of an instrument wound over tight. It was no wider than his hand, and its bark bit into his chest, and soon his chest began to ache from it. He did not know why he was in the apple tree, or what he was looking for, but he lay waiting. In time, the side of the barn glowed red. One of the kennel dogs pressed into its run and looked around and retreated. The morning air was bright and water-laden. From downfield, a killdeer chattered, "Kidee, kidee." Almondine floated into the kitchen, padding along on old legs. She paused beside the stove and circled the table and disappeared. Then Edgar's mother walked into view, robe cinched around her waist. She stood with her back to the window and started the Mr. Coffee. She lifted her hair in a rope and dropped it outside her robe and waited. She filled her cup. She liked coffee black with just a bit of sugar. He'd made it for her many times that winter. and he watched her lift the spoon from her cup and put it wet into the sugar bowl twice and sip the coffee. The corner of the kitchen was windowed on two sides. She stood in profile, looking west at the vapor writhing over the field. When Claude appeared, he was dressed as if he had just arrived. He walked up behind her and put one hand on her shoulder and let it rest there. He smoothed the collar of her robe against her neck and walked to the sink and rinsed out a cup. He didn't look out then, just turned and poured his coffee and sat in the chair nearest the sink. Their murmur penetrated the window glass, but not their words. After a few minutes, Edgar's mother set her cup on the table and walked to the bathroom. Claude sat watching the Mercator of sunlight advance up the field. Wisps of fog swirled and thinned under the new heat of morning. A flock of sparrows lit at the bird feeder at the corner of the house, bickering and flapping one another out of the way, so close Edgar could have snatched one. Edgar lay in the tree and watched. Claude was leaner than his father, and though he was younger and without his father's bookish stoop, his hair was shot with gray. He sat in Edgar's father's chair and pursed his lips and brought the coffee cup to his mouth. Edgar had been afraid he would see them kiss. Almandine went up to Claude and raised her face, and Claude smoothed his hand over the top of her skull. Edgar's mother emerged from the bathroom, hair turbaned. Incandescent light from the bedroom fell across the kitchen table. Claude stood and went to the sink and rinsed out his coffee cup, and finally he looked out that window. Maybe he didn't know what he'd seen at first. His gaze passed aimlessly across the tree and moved on. Edgar had time to wonder if the new leaves were camouflage enough to hide him, though it didn't seem possible, and he didn't care anyway. Claude swabbed the dishcloth in his cup and picked up a towel and began to dry it. But somewhere in the back of his mind, there must have been a twinge, a nag, an afterimage. For when he lifted his face again, he looked straight at Edgar, and then he shuddered and stepped back from the sink. A step back. A small motion, perfectly natural, if any reaction can be said to be natural, when you realize someone has climbed a tree outside the window and has been watching like a panther for God knows how long. Since you woke up, perhaps. You lean forward. The boy's hair is wet and dripping, as if he has been there all night in the rain. He has a frozen, impudent look on his face, as if the pane of glass between you could protect him from anything, from everything. And if he blinks, you do not see it. After a long stare, to be sure you are seeing what you see, you understand that the boy has been up there all along. The rustle wouldn't have escaped your attention, even if you had been half asleep and distracted. And the birds would never have battled like they did over the feeder, just an arm's length away. You weigh the idea that this is a prank. You lean back and try to quietly laugh as if you are in on it. You turn your back and set the coffee mug down on the table and then look out the window again and watch with false equanimity as the boy peers back, hands clasped around the bough he is balanced so far out upon. And when his mother comes up behind you, you turn and face her, and that is when you kiss. You unselfconsciously kiss. Her hand lingers on your shoulder. You stand with your back to the window, saying nothing about what you have seen as she pulls her coat off the hook. She says one last thing, and then she and Almandine are out the door and walking toward the barn. you turn back to the window. Though you expect him to have looked away to gaze at his mother and the dog as they cross the yard, he has not. His expression is slack, and his eyes fill his face. He is all watching, no reacting. And a small voice in the back of your mind says, "This is a boy that spends his days watching. You're not going to win a staring contest." And you get to thinking as well, he's still staring from his wet perch, that if this is a contest, then you have already lost. Because in that moment, when you first understood what you were seeing through the window, when your eyes said it was so and your mind replied it was impossible, in that moment, as you think of it from the boy's viewpoint, you know you looked frightened. You stepped back from the window, back from the sight of his foreshortened body, fronted by that face, those eyes, that shock of hair hanging over his forehead, dripping. You stepped back and looked up, and your eyes were wide. Now you glance up again, attempt an insolent grin, but it does not come off easily. It comes off forced, and the grin fades as if the muscles of your face have grown paralytic. And this is also something the boy can see, who has not once looked away or betrayed an emotion. But your failure to muster a smile isn't what gets to you. What gets to you is that the boy seems to be reading your mind, can hear these thoughts, and this makes you wonder what else he has seen, what else he might know or guess. And as you lock gazes and you finally force the amused smile you wish had come easily, what unnerves you, what finally makes you turn away, is that without moving a muscle or blinking an eye, he begins to smile back. Thanks. Okay, Andy, we stay up here, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you for those very solemn and powerful readings. I think most of you know the way this works. If you put your hand up, we'll call on you. We'll please wait for the microphone. Who would like to start us off?
Style points to whoever gets the first question in. It's the hardest.
All the way in back there in the blue. And then is there another question? We'll get a mic to you now. Nope. All right. It's good night after this.
This is for Mr. Ume, if I've got that correct. We were trying to mobilize young African-American children to come tonight. And I guess I'm worried about the high level of violence as much as I grew up with the Hutu, you know, well aware of the history. And as lovely as the story is, I'm a little concerned that children, it's not a book for children to hear. It's a comment meant in warmth and good faith, but that's it.
Would you like to respond?
When I read this book at first, children who are my friends, they were very eager to want to read. We hear you've written a book about us children. And I said to them, the book is about you, but it's not for you. You know, it's not for you. The world is shaped by adults. People many times would say to me, what can we do for the children of Africa? You know, the children of the world. And I just say to them, look, You cannot get to these children until you go, unless you go through the adult. What mother is going to allow you to talk to her kid? What father? You know, so until we change that world of the adults, nothing will work well for the kids. So I'm perfectly okay that adults are here tonight. Thank you.
In the center right here, second row.
This question is for David Rubleski. I understand that the story of Edgar Stottel was in the works for 10 years, and I just wondered, when did you begin to think that you might actually write a novel?
It was in the works for 10 years. Actually, by the calendar, it would be more like 15 years. I used to underplay. I used to say, well, maybe 8 years, because I always thought there's a writer listening who wants to start writing a novel. When they hear 10 years, they'll say, oh, forget it. I'm going to go to the movies. and so I certainly never said 15 years. And somebody once pointed out to me that maybe there was someone listening who'd been working on a novel for 12 years and needed to know if they would just stick with it for a couple more years. It would work out. This was a project that went very slowly for me, especially at first. As a first novel, I didn't understand the form as someone who's making it. I'd been reading novels all my life, and they seemed like the most natural form of storytelling imaginable. You know, they're just novels. What could be so hard about writing one? And at the moment I began working on making one of my own, all that felt natural and inevitable about the novel as a form fell apart for me. And suddenly I looked at it and I said, well, this is absurd, a 500-page story. That's a totally unnatural way of telling a story. But unfortunately, I'm a terrible short story writer. In fact, I'm a terrible poet. I've written short stories, and as a humanitarian act, they live in my file drawer, locked, where no one can read them. So I had no alternative but to just keep working on this thing. And I don't know when I turned the corner and said, "Oh, it's going to really work." It's going to come together as a novel. Whether it would be published or not was an entirely separate question. But whether I would actually be able to complete a draft of it and say, at one level or another, I've written a novel, that took many years. I was probably 6 or 7 years in before I turned that corner and thought, oh, I'm going to make it to the end of at least one draft. But there have been, at least the way I count it, 12 drafts of this book. And so not all of them took the same amount of time, obviously. And at every point, it became a slightly different book. You know, at every draft, I came to a new understanding of what I was trying to do, but very slowly. So not a satisfyingly concise answer, I know. But, you know, my experience has been that this has gone on. It was a very gradual process, and it was very much a case of learning how the thing worked by paying attention to it and listening to it in a way and watching it to see what it was going to be good at and what it wasn't. Thanks for your question.
Next question. About four rows back right here, and then we'll go up to the lady on our left.
Normally, if I haven't read the books, I don't come to the lectures. Because I'm embarrassed. I haven't read either book yet there in my home. And I'm about to. But I do have a question, despite that, for both of you. Number one, how did you and why did you pick the particular chapter to read? What did you want us to learn from it, either if we had or had not yet read the book? And for you, did you cry as you wrote that book? And for you, did you change your perspective over 10 years? You must have changed in some way. And how did that show itself in your writing?
You go.
All right. That's smooth. You see that handoff there? That was smooth. Did did I change my perspective, or did my perspective on the book change over the course of time? Absolutely. One way that I can describe the experience of writing a novel, and you know, one of the few advantages of being a first timer is that you see things that people who have done it over and over and over again are so used to they can't even see. So one of the few advantages of being a novice is that the first time through, everything is vivid to you. And for me, the best way I can describe what writing this book was like is that it was like going into my garage and trying to build a one-of-a-kind musical instrument out of the spare parts that I found lying around, while at the same time trying to compose the best possible music to play on that instrument. Okay? And you know, I walked into that metaphorical situation with a certain kind of music in mind, but I didn't necessarily have all the parts I needed to build the instrument that could play it. And at the same time, as I messed around with this thing that I was making, I discovered that it was capable of certain kinds of riffs and other transpositions that I'd never imagined. And that changed the kind of music that I wanted to play in the first place. And so there's a kind of give and take between how the book is shaping up and how you want to tell that story, or even what the story is. And it's not easy to encapsulate that, but that's the nature of the process. And you hope it converges. It doesn't have to. And I think in the cases where it doesn't, you know, those are the novels that get set aside, and then you move on to some other project. In this case, luckily, the two things converged over time. So in a sort of very broad general way, that was what the experience was like, and that's how my perspective changed. I mean, I always imagined this book about Edgar. I didn't always imagine it being told from the point of view it was told in. The first draft was done half of it was done in first person. And I ended up having to rewrite it into a revolving third person. But, and as far as choosing a selection to read, there are many factors involved in that. Sometimes I just read something different because I've been reading a different passage as time goes on. But mainly, it's a little tricky. You have to find something that stands somewhat alone and isn't totally confusing for people. And so as it turns out, even in a novel of 500 or 600 pages, there are really only a few passages that make sense and that you can read at a microphone. Like I'm terrible at reading dialogue, so I tend to look for passages that don't have dialogue in them. So once you factor in all the constraints, you're down to just a few sections. Okay, now it's your turn.
Before I handle your nice question, I want to acknowledge the presence of people from my publishing house, Heather Fain and Terry. These people have been very sweet to me, and being a foreigner in your country, sometimes they come to my readings the way family members would come, you know, to my reading. So thank you, Heather. Thank you, Terry. They've come in from New York City. Did I cry as I read this book? It was a difficult book to write. And I just read this scene to you, this painful one of the scenes in my book. I've done it in like 10 or 15 minutes. But writing it, I had to live with this and go into that scene many, many times to get the details right. Yeah, so many times it was very difficult. And I would have to run to the next story because I write many stories at the same time. So I run from this one to the next, and before I knew it, I would be in some sad scene again. I would, you know, flee from there. So yeah, it was a painful book to write, but I felt I had to write the book, and my prayer to God was their children, their people who have lived through these disasters. They still have a sense of humor. They still have hope. They smile. Some of them are still able to live with people. God, let not my telling of these stories destroy me. You know, this business of the artists just dying in the process of bringing this beautiful, you know, thing to light. And it happens so, you know, it happens often to many of our contemporary artists who their lives just, you know, become wretched because of the beautiful music, the beautiful art they're going to, you know, they're into. So I was very conscious of, you know, how to balance, you know, my situation and not be overwhelmed by this fictional, you know, situation. So, yes, it was very difficult. It took me 8 years to write this book. I started in the year 2000, and it was published 2008. I was in the seminary when I started. So, daytime I would be studying for the priesthood. At night, I'll be writing. I couldn't do it every night. I did it like 3 nights a week. So again, the sense of balance so that I would not be thrown out of the seminary. I think David has provided a compelling answer to why we pick the passages we've read from. I always try to look for a beautiful scene, so I'm hoping that, you know, that that scene about the landscape of Rwanda, you know, gives you some image of this is a beautiful country. And then this sustained scene also tells you what happened. And I picked that scene because I did not have to say much to introduce the scene, and yet it's sustained. It, you know, it speaks for, you know, for itself. So, David, there must be an advantage to going second. Thank you.
Lady on our left over here.
This may be a bit delayed. I just wanted to respond to what was said at the very beginning in the back, and that is that, you know, I think that this is a story that really should be told to children, and I wish there were more that were here, because I taught this summer to a group of high school students who knew all about the Holocaust in Philadelphia and had never heard of Rwanda and didn't know about what had happened there. So, you know, it's violent, yes, that's a fact, and I hope more children were here to hear what happened, because I think it's not widely enough known.
Yeah. My only response to that is when I said children, I was thinking of 6-year-old, 5-year-old, high school certainly, you know, sure, you know, they should come. They could come and listen to, you know, what is happening in other parts of the world.
A few more questions. Gentleman here on our right, 4 rows back, 5 rows back.
Hi, this question is for Mr. Ackman. Reading the first story and Xmas Feast, there was kind of like no character to really have hope in. So with the situation of Mesha's family, from the perspective of the writer, do you think that there's any form of redemption for a situation as dismal as that?
Thank you very much. Many, many times people ask, you know, is there hope in your stories? Is there hope for people on your continent? People ask that question, you know, all the time. Yes, there is redemption. The children in my stories, they want what your children want. They're bright, they're resilient, you know, they're hopeful. It's the world of the adult that is flawed. And the children show courage, they love each other, and they even forgive the adults. Okay, so they've come off wiser than, you know, the adults. And I always say it bothers me that in the Western world, where opportunities are countless, schools are working, food is there, the external world is very beautiful, yet we deal with stuff like child suicide in this country. In our universities, students are taking their lives. Why? Yet, in these developing countries, where resources are very scarce, the children are not standing there hoping to kill themselves. They believe they'll make it. They struggle daily. Anybody who has ever gone outside this country to the developing countries, you know, you'll notice this, that people are vibrant. They have something to hold onto. So over there, the external worlds have collapsed, but they have this resilience. So what is missing here? Will technology solve our problems? You know, many kids in high schools here, you mentioned high schools, are hurting. You know, if you're a teacher, you will know this. You will see this. And so it's not all about I eat three times a day, I have clothes, I have laptops, I have the latest gadgets. You know, what is missing? Where is the disconnect, you know, which makes us, in spite of all this technology, we are struggling in terms of resilience and hopefulness. But the children of my story, if you read them very carefully, they have a lot of hope, and they don't break down in the midst of the most difficult situation. They find a way around. In my stories, you have people dying to save their neighbors. They sacrifice their lives. Maisha, the daughter in my story, she wants to send his brother to school. Okay, that task has been given to her by the family. So she's in prostitution to send this brother to school. And the brother cannot stand that. So the brother doesn't want that. Okay, how come these children, 12 and 8, are making these decisions? And they have that moral weight, you know, to say, I don't want this. Or I'm going to sacrifice everything to show that I love my, you know, my family. So I wasn't out to write about stories with a happy ending. You know, I was out to say in the midst of these tragic situations. And by the way, these are just some places in Africa, conflicts. You know, there are some places that are doing well, like Ghana is doing very well these days, Botswana, and in many ways, South Africa. So yes, there is hope, there is redemption. And sometimes in this country, you will see the victims of the genocide in Rwanda. And you will be amazed at how resilient, you know, they are. One thing about the passage I read tonight is for many of us Christians, or religious people for that matter, we want to shove our religion down the throats of anybody who doesn't want to believe. What arrogance. What arrogance. Now, Maisha takes this cross broken and crushed, the way Christ carried it in Calvary, with a lot of humility. And it's still shining bright for her. So, people who are believers, Muslims, Christians, Hindus, you know, calm down a bit. Yeah. Let's see it in your actions, you know.
I don't know how we follow that up. gentleman right there.
This has been an incredible treat for me, and I almost look at this as a historical event. If you go back before the journalism phase of history, artists were the people who taught us living history. It seems to me that you are using your gift as an artist to portray history in a way that a journalist can't. Or your stories are wonderful, their stories, but they all have meaning, they all have intensity, they all have emotion, and I think they have a greater impact than a pure journalistic event possibly could. I think to do that, you have to have an incredible gift, and I think your book, which I have not read and I intend to read, has to be incredibly powerful because of this gift you have to give us living history.
They're both very powerful books, and unfortunately,
we're
out of time. Oh, did you want to say something? Sorry. All right. Ladies and gentlemen, Uwam Akpan and David Robleski. Yeah. Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.